Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I particularly wanted to raise race issues, and I realized that Continetta Horn's question an hour ago is the perfect way to do it. It's a question that should make us all stop in our tracks when she asked, why is it that they bring out the army for Aboriginal peoples? They do lots of things in common for everybody. Everybody suffers a lot in common, but when it's Aboriginal peoples, they bring out the army. And I took that question to be one of the most important questions we can ask and answer today, not only because the army is actually being brought out today as we speak for Aboriginal peoples in Caledonia, but because it is a very important question in order to understand what security thinking that we've been struggling with, what that is all about. To me, the answer lies both with race and with land. It's important to understand that there are different racisms, and the kind of racism meted out to Aboriginal peoples is different from that meted out to other peoples. It's not in order to set up a hierarchy that I make that comment. It's simply to point out that when a particular racism combines with land, what you have is extraordinary violence. And my short answer to Continetta Horn is the army comes out because we are still on Aboriginal land. And Aboriginal peoples have been for 150 years evicted out of the category human. And put in the category subhuman. Many of us would say that has also happened to our groups. I want to make a plea that we keep thinking about this in historically specific ways in order to understand the kind of violence that is brought out and to understand also the difference in legal measures that are brought out. Joanne very clearly made the point that there is a different legal organization for what is meted out to immigrants. And that's important to understand. We should also put that alongside of the legal mechanisms that enable the violence against Aboriginal peoples. And in all of these cases, what we need to think about, which I would like to put on the table the most today, is the way in which race thinking accustoms us to the idea that this kind of violence is warranted. We actually come to believe in it, and it no longer appears as a violence. It just appears as the law. And I think that that's perhaps the most important point I want to make today, is that race thinking, which is captured in the phrase, they are not like us, that kind of thinking becomes embedded in law and bureaucracy, so that you have a terrifying union of state machinery and race thinking, one that's one scholar called the dance of bureaucracy and race. And I think that's what we most need to keep in mind. When people are cast out of legal community and political community, when we suspend their rights, that is a move that is legally made. As many scholars have called that, that's the force of law without law. Why is this significant? Because it indicates the extraordinary power of the state in this instance. And it indicates that these kinds of legal measures really allow for what one scholar, Agamben, has called a kind of legal civil war, where we can physically eliminate political adversaries and entire categories of citizens who for some reason cannot be integrated into the society. A suspension of law and a suspension of in the name of law easily conceals violence so that it appears to be the violence itself appears as law, so that those who implement these kinds of measures, judges, lawyers, bureaucrats, ordinary people who follow this, don't experience themselves as engaging in a suspension of rights or engaging in violence. What they experience themselves as is engaging in fulfilling their duty. It is exactly like Adolf Eichmann in sending the trains to the Nazi concentration camps when he was finally tried in Israel. What he actually said was, I was fulfilling my duty. And I think it's important for us as activists to understand this particular psychic move where people perform extraordinary acts of racism and violence in the name of duty, defense of country, patriotism. So that one outstanding feature of racial violence is that racist effects become sort of routinized and embedded in arrangements that systematically cut off people's opportunities on every turn. But they hide the violence. Okay, so what does race thinking look like? There's one quick point I have to start with here. When race thinking is directed against Arabs and Muslims, the form that it appears in is the clash of civilizations. So it appears as, here we have a modern, enlightened, law-abiding society, ours, threatened by a pre-modern, non-law-abiding, super-religious society. And when it becomes phrased as that, you always have to watch when you get positioned in the equation as not in modern times, as in pre-modern times, as in pre-law times, because that becomes the reasoning that is used to direct violence against you. I am running out of time, but I really wanted to show you, just from looking at the transcripts of these hearings, of security certificate hearings, what does this actually look like on paper when you see this kind of violence? What does it appear like? And what is most striking when you sit down with hundreds of these pages is that there is no overt logic to how we deny people rights except for one outstanding coherent line of argument. They are not like us. And that line of argument manages to make sense of what normally we would not make sense of. So, for example, in a certificate trial, when a certificate hearing, when a CSIS officer is on the stand and he is asked, well, how do you know that Hassan Al-Mray is actually, you know, associated with Al-Qaeda? 30,000 people like Hassan Al-Mray actually went to Afghanistan. How do you tell whether the profile you have actually drawn up is one that corresponds to a hard and fast fact? What strikes you as reading that, and I emphasize reading it as a non-lawyer, what strikes you is how absolutely incoherent the answer is. And the answer to that question is, there need not be an answer to that question, which is how race thinking combines with this state machinery so that nonsense actually becomes sense in some way. And so CSIS actually says things on the stand, and it would be quite shocking if you actually looked at the list of things that they say, which then becomes accepted as fact. They say things like, well, I can't prove it, but I guess what you have is the opinion of a white Anglo-Saxon Canadian. Well, if that were actually said anywhere else, everyone would say, come on, that's racist, get over it, come up with something better than that. But that's allowed to stand. If they actually say, well, you know, this profile doesn't correspond to fact, the answer to that question, again, is, well, it doesn't have to. And what I want to emphasize here that was so striking for me is that we have been taking on, and Joanne made a very strong case, for what results when all of this hinges on the fact that evidence is secret. What has really impressed me is that what is not secret is not logical either. So that even without the secrecy problem, we still have a situation where people are actually saying on the stand the most outrageous things and getting away with it because it need not make sense. But it does make one particular kind of sense. And that is, in order to convince people that this is an argument that works, what individual CSIS agents do or what the state eventually accepts and judges right into their decisions is to invoke the idea that these people are not like us, and they use concepts that powerfully convey that idea. For example, the concept of a sleeper cell, which, by the way, was also the concept used against Japanese Canadians and Japanese Americans. And the way that we persuaded people in the 1940s was to say, you know, these Japanese, they're completely inscrutable. We never know what they're thinking. It's for sure that they're organizing behind our backs. This kind of thinking prevails today as well. And so we have certain red flags that are used in place of facts and arguments. And these organizing features that give an argument strength and coherency all have to do with race. It has to do with the mysterious, inscrutable, inherently violent, dangerous Arab. And those kinds of images are not new to us. We can call on them for several decades now. We've had those images in place. And so what you find piece by piece in the transcript is those images very cleverly doing the work that logic should do, that law should do. And that's what you see when you look at the transcripts.